James Morris is professor of theology here at Boston College and the author of numerous books, most recently Knowing the Spirit and The Reflective Heart, Discovering Spiritual Intelligence in Ibn Arabi's Meccan Illuminations. Apologies for the pronunciation. He has taught in the faculty or visiting positions at a number of universities in Europe, Asia, and the United States, most recently as the Sharjah Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter, and he frequently lectures and gives workshops throughout Europe in the Muslim world. Professor Morris holds a BA from the University of Chicago and a PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations from Harvard University. His talk today is entitled Ways of Knowing, Reintegrating Spirituality in the Catholic University and Liberal Arts. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Wayne, first of all, just I was never sure to begin with why I was invited to be on this this committee on ways of knowing. But one reason I gave myself was it might be useful to have a kind of outsider's perspective on the larger questions and the direction of the university, and both past and present. And certainly that's the way I've looked at it. And in particular, where we're discussing the sciences and philosophy and the world of the intellect, which our universities generally focus on, there's no problem relating Islamic traditions, historically at least, to that, because indeed our modern and medieval university largely was not only heavily influenced, but in many ways in its curriculum, the trivium and the quadrivium and all these things was really imitating, even down to chairs, professors and chairs, was imitating models which are taken from the Middle East during and after the Crusades. So I won't be speaking today about the intellectual parallels and all, but rather in all of the traditional Islamic sciences, people often speak about three different ways of knowing, naql, or religious tradition, aql, or the intellect, what we generally do in universities and in both the sciences, social sciences, and arts, and kashf, or spiritual experience. And so it struck me that in the modern university, in all parts of the world, and I know we have someone here from Ignatian spirituality, but by and large, it's not that area of human experience which was so central in pre-modern cultures, and not just in universities, but certainly in the religious traditions, is not always formally emphasized in our modern-day universities. And one thing that struck me, having taught for many years in different religious studies or studied religion departments, was that it might be helpful to say a little bit about why undergraduates go into those majors, which have become really the heart of the liberal arts wherever those programs have been established. And also, but as I began to think about that, I said, well, maybe I should back up a little bit, because the liberal arts, although most of you probably went to universities where those were central, and I did, loved it, and spent much of my life trying to update and modernize and spread that ideal. Something you quickly realize if you go anywhere else in the world is this is particularly an American, maybe American and Canadian, but not even the rest of the Americas, and certainly not in Europe, Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. It's not a discipline which has any currency or any historical roots. So somehow people are dealing with spiritual issues in their universities and otherwise in different ways in other cultures and so forth. So the first thing I wanted to emphasize is what I have to say is more of my background, and to say that I'm talking about a challenge of how one brings spirituality and why and in what ways people bring spirituality into the university curriculum and beyond, and that not about prescriptions. I'm not intending to find fault or to argue for or against any particular curricular ideas or whatever, but I'm trying to put this in a larger perspective. And having said that, I perhaps should say a little bit about things we talked about beforehand, which is I don't know whether people in other parts of the university know what we do over in theology. Sometimes, maybe they do in D.C. And one of the particularities of a lot of my colleagues, and certainly the ones who've come here today, and philosophy, and are in theology and philosophy and religious studies, is really a meld of the two in most places that I've ever taught, is that we're constantly involved teaching and doing outreach and workshops and with groups of all ages and all different occupations, not just in parish churches, but I mean, just thinking, bookending, last weekend I was giving a Mellon workshop at Grinnell University for people from 23 liberal arts colleges about how to bring the Middle East and Islamic studies in the curriculums. That's pretty professional And Saturday I start an annual monthly series of lectures and workshops on the last book I translated, on a book of philosophy and spiritual practice and eschatology. But being held in Microsoft's offices down in New York last year, it was at Columbia University this year. I mean, it's business people, professionals, doctors, dentists, and you want to learn about this. Some of them have Iranian background. It comes from that culture, some not. But and pretty much, and I'm afraid this is true of most of my colleagues too, I have the impression we're on the road as much as we're here in the week time. We're out, you know, talking and dealing with groups. As I said, the British Council used to send me around for tours, and I'd arrive in a country and I'd never know, but in the same day I remember going to speak to a group of philosophers at noon about what's happening in the study of spirituality in the Americas, and Ibn Arabi and the Zohar and so forth, and then the afternoon at a think tank and civilization relations, and the evening at their business school. And I've been talking to schools that teach school teachers who are going to teach about religion and education. So when I'm talking about the issues I'm talking about here, I want to make it very clear that, perhaps I'll make this explicit up front, that the amazing thing about the liberal arts education, as useless as it might seem to people from any other parts of the world who say, why do you take this extra year in college and, you know, study all of these non-practical things, because most people's educational systems are designed to turn out a practitioner of this or that discipline or practice. The remarkable thing about it is it really prepares people to be citizens and to be creators and to be innovators in a way that most educational systems in the world don't. And so what I'm talking about here is really meant to sort of praise and build up and say that there's an important place for this peculiarly American model of liberal arts in creating the kinds of citizens the world needs globally, not just within our own country and in the larger world out there. And again, until you've gone and taught in other countries, as some many people have done here, you don't really fully appreciate how unique the liberal arts system is. So there are four parts. I know I've got 20 minutes. I've already taken five of them. But the first thing I wanted to talk about, just to put this question of spirituality and education in background, is to talk about the Islamic humanities in the agrarian world and the loss or shift from those traditional institutional, social, and cultural forms to what is essentially a new historical situation all around the world. Just because I'm an Islamicist, I'm going to say a little bit about how these things worked out in Islamic countries. But frankly, when I was a kid, my mom was from Northeast Texas and part Cherokee, and what I saw when I was taken down there in the summers in Texas was exactly what I saw when I was traveling in the 70s all over the Islamic world. And I spent a lot of time as a student and teacher in France, and again, especially in Alsace, and then in-laws in Ireland. So what I want to describe in this first part is very much applicable to traditionally Catholic or Protestant parts of the world as well. It really is the shift from the agrarian world to everything that comes afterward that's so important in changing the role of religion and what people have to, the amount of creativity people have to bear in their spiritual life in the modern world. So the Islamic humanities is a term that I kind of coined, but it's got some currency now as through colleagues and friends, for the localized forms of Islamic spiritual practice of two words that actually in everywhere in the Muslim world they call this adab. It's really like right behavior, right spiritual behavior. But there's two, these are Arabic expressions, but they're used in all Islamic languages. Deeply rooted in the Quran, both terms ihsan, which means to create what is good and what is beautiful at the same time. It's defined in a wonderful hadith as to worship God as though you see him, for even if you don't see him, he sees you. The same Arabic phrase also means, can be translated as to worship God as though you see him, and if you are not, you do see him. If your ego is effaced, you're seeing the divine in everything around you. So the between these two dimensions of ihsan, you might say that the ihsan is the spirituality at all of its dimensions from outward practice towards the deeper and deeper awareness of the divine presence in every aspect of the people around us and the world around us. Another more metaphysical phrase that all Muslim cultures use to talk about this is dhikr, zikrullah, to the remembrance of God. And music, poetry, most of the Islamic humanities are called zikr, or forms of zikr, again, meaning the remembrance of God, a wider extension, if you will, of Plato's conception of anamnesis, which is central to the Quran. But what's important about those is that throughout the Muslim world and the pre-modern Christian world as well, these were deeply embedded in a context of practical, agrarian, economic, and social life. And in particular, something that our students had no idea of, that presence had a great deal to do with the presence and contemplation of nature and the natural order and symbolism that grows out of that. If I have to explain to my students that when you go to the Eucharist, that the people bringing their offerings was once they didn't bring them in money, they brought them in grain and fruits. And so the transformation of the things of this world into the spiritual blood and bread is the very essence of the human condition, practically realized in any farmer's life as you take what is given. And it's sort of, so it's not, it's an epitome practice once a week or every day, depending how often you went to Mass, of this actual process of the transformation through all the conditions of human life, of matter into spirit, or of discovery of the spirit and all of its material manifestations. And the same was true of, I've just mentioned the Eucharist, because it's so obvious there to anybody who's grown up in a farming agrarian situation, but not something that our students are likely to catch on to today, unless you point it out and explain it. It's not quite the same as actually having grown the bread and the wine that you're transforming and that you're participating in with all of the other people of your community. Just to give some examples of the Islamic humanities that you'll find everywhere in the Islamic world, above all, music and dhikr. Music and poetry are the two Islamic arts par excellence. And everywhere, and I traveled in this, again, pre-agrarian Muslim societies, everybody was a musician, and there were occasions for singing, for playing your instruments at all times of the week. Again, this was understood as praising God, or as part of the remembrance of God. And that music was often sung to poetry, and again, the contents of that poetry were often the ideas, at least, of the great mystical poets in the Quran. And something else that's very much a part of that in any traditional society is dreams and visions. Dreams aren't just something you take to your psychologist and don't tell anybody about, but dreams and communication with the spiritual world, whether through dreams or visions, are something that's part and parcel of everyone's life from childhood onward. That there's always, in one way or another, local human beings that are exemplars of our relationship with God, that we call in the Quran, Awliya Allah, the friends of God, or those who are close to God. It may be through living people, sheikhs, guides, and so forth, and many women who are like this. By the way, there's always at least as many, if not more, women who are involved in this than men in a traditional rural society. I'm having to bridge here as I go along. Yes, devotions and pilgrimages in particular, and festivals surrounding that concretize that relationship with these spiritual intermediaries and objects of devotion. And again, I'm not saying just that within the space of a few years I went from the Berber mountains of Morocco to Kurdish areas in Iran, to Khorasan, to western Afghanistan, and so wherever I went, this is what I found. And by the way, it was I wouldn't say it was any different in rural Ireland or in, I remember going back even in the 90s to do a course in pilgrimage based in Strasbourg. We ended up going all over Europe and then to Morocco or to Istanbul during the course. But that there again, the practices of pilgrimage that I describe and the devotional life deeply rooted in local practice. There were 35 Marian pilgrimages just in the two départements on the French side of the Vosges Mountains, still very active at different times of the year. So basically, if you were into Mary, you could be going on a pilgrimage up to some beautiful mountaintop spring or shrine pretty much any week of the year. These weren't all like at the same time. They were pretty much at different times. And of course, in Swabia and on the other side in Germany, you had pretty much the same kind of profound rooting of Catholic tradition. Of course, on the Alsatian side, you had Jewish and Protestant communities that live side by side for hundreds of years as well. But again, I'm not talking about something that's unique to Islam, and so I want to emphasize that this was true of Catholicism in most places where I lived and worked before the onslaught of modernization. So within these kinds of, the next thing to notice is that spirituality in those contexts was always embedded in a local, what was at the same time an ethical and economic context, a family, tribe, and village. Sometimes it might be segmented by, as I mentioned, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, or Persian and Kurdish villagers, or Twelver and Ismaili Shiites. But the important thing is that there was no separation, no conceivable separation there between one's economic and ethical life and spirituality. These weren't like different things you practiced on different days of the week. And what they have in common, and what I think people just, if they haven't grown up in a village or been in those situations, find hard to understand, is that they provide feedback. Whether we're talking about spiritual experience and its interplay, or we're talking about the relationships of men and women in particular, that in that kind of situation, nothing that's unjust or evil or, you know, can get too far, because you've always got family members, or in the area of spirituality, nothing that's too like weird and out of sync with people can get very far, because it's immediately socialized, it immediately has economic and social impact. And I don't know, feedback is something I borrowed from the sciences, but I think it's so central to understanding the mechanisms of justice and learning and education in any dimension of life, starting with parenthood and how we raise our children and going on into the largest possible schemes. Now, the reason I emphasize that feedback, which is at once economic, ethical, spiritual, very, very concretely practical, gender-based, in those situations is because it's so utterly absent in the lives that most people lead in the modern world. I mean, unless you can literally go astray for months and years and lifetimes and never encounter the feedback you need to put things back into balance or correct them. And of course, many of the things that our students fight for in terms of human rights and so forth are things where they're fighting not traditional religious life, but what happens to traditional religious life when it suddenly disappears and is not replaced by anything that corresponds to those social and cultural mechanisms that existed everywhere only a few decades ago. Now, one of the interesting ways that Islam dealt with the conflict that's always human between the individuality of spiritual experience and communal demands was, and it's already deeply rooted in the Quran, is the distinction between exoteric dimensions, which we would call ritual or dogma, and the esoteric domain of creativity and experience. This is, again, something that has sometimes equivalents in other religious traditions, but you can't begin to understand Islam in practice without understanding this constant back and forth between, again, the exoteric worldly dimensions of ritual and practice and their wider human basis in all the areas of experience and creativity. So I just wanted to mention that, not because you're going to find many of these traditional societies existing in our own day, but as an antiquarian, and if you want to understand modern-day politics, you have to understand the trauma that takes place when people are, in the space of one generation, in the last 30 years, have been torn from those traditional contexts and suddenly placed in megalopolises, often forced to immigrate to all sorts of other parts of the world. But certainly, migration in all over the third world is probably the rule, not the exception, for males at least. Anywhere you go in the third world, this is not something peculiar to Muslim countries and the literature and culture and politics and everything. But I say for males, because often women and old folks stay back in the villages while everybody else has to go off to embark in a new world and a new life. And I wanted to talk about what happens after that next. Am I doing okay in time? Whoa, okay. Okay, key aspects of global transformation in regard to the situation or context of spirituality. So I briefly tried to summarize what things were like in the past. Now, one of the first things is that we discover is that relationship between the exoteric and the esoteric is in a way turned on its head. The example I often use is the book called the Sefer HaZohar, the sort of one of the foundational texts of both Kabbalistic and later Hasidic Judaism, because it's a wonderful book of spiritual teaching and guidance that traditionally you weren't supposed to study until you were a 40-year-old male. And now I find to get people interested in the Old Testament, it's a wonderful tool to use with teenagers. I may be blasted with some, no divine sanction has hit me yet for doing so. But it's such, what I basically find is, in fact, that there's the Paulist Catholic religious order started publishing books of translations of basic spiritual texts from Jewish and Christian and Muslim traditions, really classics, everything from the Church Fathers, that's all around down to, well, all the different genres of teachings. And almost all of these things were once meant for specialists. People were monks or nuns or at the very least priests or rabbis or imams, people who had really spent their whole life concentrating on spiritual activities. They were what Max Weber, in his term, would call specialists in the spiritual. And again, we live in a world today where not only are there very few of those specialists left, relatively speaking, the anecdotal, but when my colleague in Buddhist studies or when I go to give workshops in practical spirituality and our audiences come from all sorts of religious backgrounds, they're often held in old Catholic monasteries or convents. I just mentioned the Garrison Center over there and, across from West Point. So I have mixed feelings about this. Again, I'm not taking sides or anything. It's just says something about our time that instead, and these have often hundreds of rooms for monks or nuns, wherever it might have been. So whether it be in Europe or in the U.S., it doesn't matter. So just the fact that the recycling of these buildings and these spiritual retreat centers, and to me what's so striking is not whether what's being taught is Buddhist or Sufi or whatever the case might be, or often in a secularized form of traditional spiritual teachings, but that what has happened is the specialists have kind of faded away and spirituality has become available to many people. But the second fact that it's available in a plurality of choices and situations and forms, which never really existed for people before. My colleagues in religious studies often joke about, and this is an illustration, it's an anecdote, but you know, our students will always be fascinated by the spiritual traditions of a tradition in which they were not raised. Because sometimes, once if they're Muslim, they'll be fascinated with Jewish mysticism. If they're Jewish, they'll be fascinated with Buddhism or Islam or Sufism or whatever. Sometimes they go back and eventually rediscover their own tradition. But this is just an odd sort of peculiarity that seems to, and it happens in other parts of the world as well. But okay, so the switch in the religious frameworks in which these disciplines are studied and the plurality of available forms and choices. The third great change that we notice today is the much wider collective, it can be everything from local to global, but the ethical and public framework within which people turn to spirituality for their answers. So a lot of people who've never been involved in these traditions somehow imagine, and it's even worse in the Muslim world than here, that people who pray and fast and devote their lives, devotional practices and doing this music and all, that they're actually cut off from the world. I can assure you, as a historian of these disciplines and multiple registrations, it never was like that. And in particular, but again, people have the idea that this was something that just they specialized in. And especially when you get into new nation states, this is used to kind of say, well, we don't want any traditional religion because it rejects the world. It has nothing to do with the world. In fact, young students who are interested in these things, they're always interested in either artistic creation or in some way or another, the larger ethical issues, which, as I said, often involve the environment, ecology, justice, peace, peacemaking, harmony between communities. Basically, they're out to create the moral communities that existed at the village level, at the larger and larger levels of social and collective life that we all, as responsible citizens, are part of today. So I don't know, frankly. I would say the ratio of my students who that I've had or have been in, say, departments I've been in, I was saying beforehand, they tend to go into three areas, into working in NGOs and international relations. So they go into being doctors and therapists, probably about 60% are in medical professions of one sort or another. So they generally double majors between some science and pre-med and religious studies. Or they go into new artistic forms of creating, recreating the spiritual needs and practices that are appropriate to the world we live in today. And actually, I've got kids in my own family that have followed each of these paths in very dramatic ways. So the creativity and public engagement are absolutely central across the world to people who are interested in these disciplines in their modern forms, as, by the way, they actually were in the past when you've studied the great spiritual exemplars from these traditions. Now, I'm going to have to stop, actually, without very quickly to stay with the time framework. The one thing, but I am going to do a little exercise here, is when I sat down about 25 years ago to write about the local Islamic humanities, I sort of put together a number of basic categories, because a lot of people think that Islam is a culture where books, although important, very few people were literate, and yet there was a social and spiritual literacy that people had, which you only have to look, say, to the American South or to other cultures, that there are lots of ways to be spiritually literate and expressive besides just studying books in a university. So I wanted to go through, just to mention the key categories of cultural forms that embody spiritual teaching and spiritual communication, spiritual community in traditional Muslim societies. And what I discovered, and I sort of naively assumed that in my students' lives, that each of these would be in their Catholic or Protestant or Jewish form. Well, what I quickly discovered is, in fact, they almost never were in a traditionally religious form. That, as I said, religion kind of disappeared in these different domains. Well, it didn't disappear at all. It's simply what we called religion shrank. It's like it shrank to about 1% of what traditionally was part of religious life in pre-modern communities. So the first thing I'll give a few examples. I'm just going to go through the categories, but I may need to give it. But devotional literature and contemplative tools, prayers, invocations, blessings, elegies, often in a musical form. Again, you may know still people who go to Mass every day, who follow traditional Catholic forms of doing this. But whether it be in Muslim societies or Buddhist or Hindu or Chinese or whatever ones, most people still create those forms of devotion and contemplation, but they rarely follow them and practice them in a given, locally given social form. They have to go out and look for them. They have to have a thirst for them, and then they go out, and of course there are many different options out there. And again, I'm not opposing traditional religious forms here to what has replaced them in a modern world, but simply pointing it out that for our students, they weren't grown up and raised in anybody's particular religious form of these things. And I should know, because as a parent, sometimes I try to impose them on my own kids, and it doesn't work very well. It's like, you know, if all you have is Catholic schools and Catholic churches or Protestant schools and Protestant churches, you can do it. But as soon as they know something there, it's like, it's almost like, you know, you push your kids in this way, and after a while, you want to use reverse psychology. It's like, you know, don't put me in the briar patch, you know, Brer Rabbit psychology for kids. The second one is hagiographic tales and teachings through stories and sayings of the local spiritual exemplars, the walis, the saints, and so forth. And again, one only has to think, I mean, you know as well with your students as well, that this is going to be Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, and perhaps I'm dated mentioning Mandela or Gandhi or Martin Luther King, but that Mother Teresa, I'm sorry, Saint Teresa, I have to teach my students about Mother Teresa, they know about that. That again, it's interesting that the spiritual exemplars may come from religious backgrounds, but again, their students' interest in them and their admiration and the models that they constitute, and Obama would be, even in his, whatever happens, you can already see that with young people and him, that they're not often in traditional religious forms. They're often delighted to learn about the traditional spiritual exemplars of their tradition, but you can't start with those very much because they don't. I teach in religious quest here. This is a Catholic university. Most of the students have gone to Catholic schools in my religious quest class, but when I get to the Bible, nobody's read it. They know stories, they know parables, but I was a bit surprised. I mean, some people said, well, didn't you know, I've been married to a Catholic a long time, I didn't know some of this about Catholic school, but all the same, what it means is, what it really means, and the important thing it means, is that their images, their archetypal images today, and I was used to point this out to, I point this out to Muslim audiences, and I go, our kids are raised, the myths that they're raised on, if you watch their cartoons, that they learn at age of 2, 3, 4, and 5 today, the mythical figures they are from Japanese or Chinese mythology. And they learned, you know, I mean, they may have parallels in Irish mythology or in other things, but they're growing up, the children all over the world grow up in a culture of mythology and a visual culture and image culture where their symbols and archetypes are drawn largely from sources that none of us know much about. I mean, I just, like I said, I had a lot of kids for a long time, and I did pay attention to what they watched on TV. And that helps to explain why we really have to work hard to make Muhammad or Jesus or Saint X or Y or Z somebody that's really important to them, because, again, the ways that they approach the world on that level of their visual and symbolic culture is very different. Phenomenology of actual spiritual experience, you know, it's not an accident that people get interested in studying different spiritual traditions in adolescence, because it's really the point at which they become self-conscious and seeking. This has always been the case. Education has always kind of started and taken a different tack at adolescence there. But here again, the paradoxes, image of parables, aphorisms, disciples' notes of spiritual teaching, this kind of thing, which is so deeply embedded in traditional cultures of any part of the world, again, is something that by and large today, the sky's the limit as to what's available to people, but they don't get it in their church or their mosque or any religious setting. Again, there, it's sort of, and you only have to think of film, which I use all over the world because it's such a wonderful cross-cultural tool, but films are often the places where people do learn about the phenomenology of spiritual experience and whatever culture they come from. Again, we may not be watching, a lot of people, their eyes glaze over, then they think of the Hollywood movies they've seen and think, whoa, what is this? But I'm really, you know, talking, there's an awful lot of film out there, which is the modern day equivalent of traditional spiritual teaching tools, that they tend to be not so popular, but they're there being produced in every culture and every language. Music and dance, this is perhaps the most obvious one. As I mentioned earlier, in traditional Muslim societies, you have music everywhere, and people participating, and in fact, I've been at places when people brought in boomboxes or they brought in radios. I was in Herat when this happened in Afghanistan. And in the space of a year, the traditional music culture disappeared. I mean, you still had performers for weddings, circumcisions, funerals, Quran reciters, and so forth, but the mass participation in music disappeared and people became consumers. And of course, in many of these areas of religious life, the interplay between reception and what I call participation in religious and cultural spiritual forms of life, reception but also creation and participation, it can disappear overnight in different areas of modernization. And here, what's interesting is you find that people are recreating the phenomenon of zikr by Keegan and themselves in their own musical universe. If you've ever been over to the Plex, you know, it's like, People don't interact with other human beings. They're always in the world of music. They have these pods they've grown. Again, I talk about these same changes in Muslim countries, and it's amazing. If people don't have kids, they don't even sometimes realize how different, how books are something of the past. And again, but it's also very important that music and dance become, people don't just have any music. They have a very personalized selection of music on their iPod, which spiritually speaks to them. And when it ceases to, they change it. They switch to something else. This has happened in the past. And we're talking about consumption, not yet creation. Adab, food, ritual, ceremonies, social codes that have a spiritual meaning. There again, those change from culture to culture. But what you find is when people lose the religiously significant ones in their upbringing, they start recreating new forms, new ways of doing grace before or after meals, new ways of giving thanks, new rituals that often are started in the family context and expand out from there. Pilgrimages and saints' festivals, which are such a central part of practical Islam and in traditional societies. Here again, one reason I gave the course in pilgrimages, so we call it pilgrimage, memory, and identity. And of course, in the modern world, we have all sorts of religious pilgrimage, but we don't call it that. In particular, as I pointed out, you know, we start out in our religious quest course asking people, well, where have you had spiritual experience, where religious experience, transforming ones? And it's usually on vacations to holy places, holy sites in nature, often which were holy, explicitly holy ones from the Native Americans. We call them national parks now, or state parks, or whatever, but it's still pilgrimage to the same kinds of places you went traditionally in other cultures, or to historically fundamental and transforming experiences, which again are the often a place is a great sacrifice, be it taken to Verdun in France, you know. And by the way, one thing that I'm not going to have time to say too much about, but I want to point out here something that's very important. If you look at the modern day corollaries of the traditional forms of spiritual culture and life, is that they cut across people's religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds. So it's not just that they've taken on these new and diverse forms, but that people participate in them. A word that is very big in journalistic depictions of religion called belief doesn't exist in the Quran. It's never been, from my point of view, very important, at least in non-Christian religions. People don't believe in this. They practice all of it. You can't help but practice it, and often again in the modern world it isn't explained by belief. They don't have a belief system or a way of contextualizing it. Simply, people go to these holy places, they participate in them, and then they begin to seek the deeper meaning of them. So you work from the practice, as people always had, into meaning and expectation, and then at a further level into creation and communication. And that's the last point I would like to say, is in Islam in general, the high cultural Arabic language expressions of these Islamic humanities, and often the ones in which people were learned, that they had this multiple publicity functions they did in Christianity or Judaism, defending certain practices or of apologetics for them. And you also had then at that level the philosophic, the truly philosophic, constructive transformations of those learned disciplines to reflect, that were meant to guide the learned in their guidance of the larger community. I spent a lot of time, my life, reading and translating those higher philosophic theological writings, but they are, unless they are translated into practice through transforming teachers, they are epiphenomenal. The things I've described are not epiphenomenal. They're rites, rituals, cultural elements that everybody participates in which the spirit is actually embodied and reflected back to people in their own communities. And so when I talk about religion and the liberal arts, the place not to start is with philosophy. Well, it is to start for those people who have a philosophic gift or a theoretical gift. But for most people, what they find that they do, what draws them to the study of spirituality, and here at BC it takes place in many different departments, so it's, to me it's not important whether we have something called religious studies. But what they're trying to do by going back into the historical study of religious traditions is to find and recognize in those historical forms the explanatory context which will provide them with the justification and the inspiration for creating new forms that are going to be meaningful and effective. And I call this communication. You can call it creation, because real communication is always creation. But so people go back to study these things, not out of, you know, some people think, they used to call it when I was a kid, comparative religions or the history of religions. These were European, very learned graduate disciplines that still exist in great, wonderful European universities. The study of religion at an undergraduate level may have grown out of those disciplines, but it really has very much to do with people finding the context, which is at once practical and intellectual and truly spiritual, in past religious traditions for answering and responding to their own ethical, spiritual, and creative challenges that they feel just as human beings. And so it's a wonderfully recreated discipline whose forms are going to necessarily change and shift as the forms of the wider popular, and you know, I was going to say, as the forms of the wider popular culture change. But, you know, when I was educated, we were already in the TV generation. I have to be careful about this term popular culture, because it's actually the culture in which people exist. Because it used to be we could see pop culture as a kind of the people. We knew the filmmakers. We knew what Bergman was doing when he did his films. We could go back to the theologies and go back to the, you know, the Protestant disciplines and the things he'd undergone and see how his films grew out of that. Most filmmakers today, most artists, most musicians today, most people who have a spiritual vocation, they're not that rooted in this or that particular. They're rooted in a culture, obviously, but in ways that they're not that conscious, I should perhaps just say they're not that conscious of. And so this division, old-fashioned division, between the high literate culture and its popular expression is not very helpful to us as teachers at any level and with any audience any longer, because there's not any particular part of the world I can think of where people are any longer looking to guidance to somebody who's more educated or somehow much more deeply rooted in the tradition. This was the exoteric, esoteric way of looking at things for thousands of years, really, in human society. But we're now in a world in which, really, to make your even learned understanding effective and accessible to people, you have to draw on appropriate means, be it films, be it literature, be it music, whatever they might be. And I try them all, and I keep having to relearn them all with new generations of students in order to communicate with them. Because this, in a way, what we're experiencing today, as I was saying to you before, was that we have the illusion that things were much more stable and much more traditional and fixed in the past. When we go back and look at the past, what we actually see is creativity, adaption, recreation in ways that are really inspiring for the world that we live in today. So I was going to say more, but certainly I think the one point I'd like to leave us on, I actually had listed all the disciplines in the modern university and showed which ones provide the context for understanding religious and spiritual life and which ones in which the students find their expressions. Perhaps it's just important to say that from the student's point of view, that's the way things are divided between contextualization and then places where you can take that contextualization and apply your spiritual creativity out into the world, ethics, psychology, ecology, politics, medicine, international relations, business management, creative arts, all of those disciplines. So, by the way, we're welcome as religion teachers, theologians. We're welcome in those disciplines. People are often, those things are taught in a kind of sterile way where the purpose of those disciplines is never quite taken up. So it doesn't matter. We have interlocutors in all those disciplines, and of course that's where our students are going to apply their learning and apply their impetus. And the key role here is no longer the discipline, no longer the intellectual. You have to have that to be a teacher and be a good teacher, but the key role remains the human being, the role of the teacher as the catalyst who makes that connection between tradition on the one hand and its necessarily new and creative and expressions, be it through the arts or be it in politics and ethics and ecology. That role of the teacher is, well, I hate to say it, but I think I can say it at BC, which is like I like teaching here. Teachers are spiritual teachers, whether they like it or not. And I don't think any Jesuit's going to be upset with me for saying that. But I could, you know, in a lot of secular schools, I could get in trouble for saying that. But that is really, I think, one of the great benefits of, I mean, there are challenges of teaching in a Catholic environment, but one of the great benefits is you don't really have to explain to your colleagues, to your administrators, or to a certain number of the students that, in fact, teachers can't help but be, they are this spirit, they are the vehicles of the spiritual transformation of tradition, the historical social sciences and liberal arts into the forms that their students are going to apply, not just in academia, but out in all of these areas where they're so anxious to get out and change the world. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, great. Thank you.